So go ahead, Matt. Take it away.
Thanks, Dr. Bolin. So our first paper was published in Journal of Thoracic Oncology by Boothman et al. So the title is Impact Patient Characteristics, Prior Therapy, and Sample Type on Tumor Cell Program Death, Ligand Expression in Patients with Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer Screen as part of the Atlantic Study. So as we all know, checkpoint inhibitors for PD-L1 have resulted in significant survival benefit for patients, but response to these drugs can be variable based on the levels of PD-L1 staining, and the levels of PD-L1 can be variable based on factors such as smoking, EGFR status, and histology. And chemotherapy and radiation have been proposed to upregulate PD-L1 expression by exposing tumor neoantigens and other mechanisms to activate the immune system. So the objective of this study was to determine the impact of patient characteristics, sample types, and prior therapies on PD-L1 expression, as well as concordance of PD-L1 expression in a subset of paired recent and archival samples. So the study utilized samples from the Atlantic Clinical Trial. So that was a phase 2 open-label study looking at third-line treatment of stage 3B to 4 non-small cell lung carcinoma with the PD-L1 inhibitor durvalumab. And in this study, the patients were heavily pretreated with two lines of chemotherapy, one of which included a platinum-based regime. So since these patients in the study had variable timing of their biopsies, it represented an opportunity to study the rate of PD-L1 positivity in patients with distinct treatment characteristics. So they looked at 1,590 patients that were all part of this Atlantic study, and this makes it one of the largest series of published PD-L1 results in literature. And as I mentioned, all the patients were stage 3B or 4, and they received at least two prior systemic therapies. And a smaller subset of these patients had both PD-L1 testing on a recent biopsy as well as an archival specimen. And all of the PD-L1 testing was performed on formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded tissue, and they used the SP263 assay, which was the companion diagnostic test for DIRVA. And then they were PD-L1 was quantified using the scoring system for that assay, with greater than 25% of tumor cells being called positive. And so there, in terms of the results, the study reaffirmed some previous identified characteristics of PD-L1, including there were significantly higher rates in patients that smoked compared with non-smokers, and that was thought to relate to increased mutations from the carcinogen exposure. They also demonstrated lower rates of PD-L1 positivity in patients with EGFR mutations at 26.1% compared with tumors without EGFR mutations. And as part of the Atlantic study, the patients had variable specimens that were used for testing, from biopsies to larger resections. Since biopsies only sample a small area of the tumor, it was possible that the kind of PD-L1 could differ between the biopsy and resection samples due to sampling. However, in this study, they didn't find any difference between the rate of PD-L1 positivity in the biopsy versus resection samples. And the prevalence of PD-L1 positivity was significantly higher in recent samples from the last 3 months compared with archival samples from either 3 months to a year to 3 months, or greater than 3 years. Just as comparison, the recent samples were 34% were positive versus the ones that were greater than 3 years were 20% positive. In their discussion, they say, well, this could be due to some analytical characteristics of the test. They more favored an alternative hypothesis that this related to kind of interim treatments or tumor progression that may have influenced the rate of PD-L1 positivity in the archival versus the recent cases. On a similar line, there was increased PD-L1 levels in metastatic samples at 36% compared with those from the primary tumors at 29%. In terms of pretreatment, there was no difference in PD-L1 status based on the patients that received tyrosine kinase inhibitors either before or after the treatments. But they did find a difference in PD-L1 positivity based on chemotherapy, with 41% positivity in those that had chemotherapy prior to sample acquisition versus 29% of those that did not. And similar with radiation as well, that they saw higher rates of PD-L1 positivity in those that received radiation at 50.4%, compared to 38% of those who had not received radiation prior to PD-L1 testing. In their smaller subgroup analysis of 123 cases with paired analysis, with recent samples less than 3 months compared with those that are longer, more than 3 months ago, they saw that PD-L1 status is unchanged in 74% of the cases. 19% of cases had an increase in PD-L1, and 6% had a decrease. And there was no difference in the small subgroup based on prior treatment. So in conclusion, the PD-L1 status can impact treatment with chemotherapy and radiation prior to sample acquisition, and this may impact patients' selection for additional therapy. And they did identify lower rates of PD-L1 positivity in older archival cases. Some limitations of the study is that they use the SP263 assay for PD-L1 testing, and it's not directly clear whether these results are directly translatable to other PD-L1 assays, including the 22C3 assay. And due to the limited number of paired samples, it's not possible to make a definitive conclusion that for an individual patient that PD-L1 is more likely to change regarding a systemic treatment. Is just kind of global analysis of that. So some of the take-home messages is that PD-L1 status is variable, and it can change due to patient or treatment characteristics. And ideally, PD-L1 testing should be performed on recent samples less than 3 months and not on archival specimens. And patients that were initially negative for PD-L1 that undergo treatment with chemotherapy or radiation may benefit from repeat PD-L1 testing after completion of these therapies.
Okay, great. Does anybody have any questions or comments about this article?
Yeah, this is Colby. I have a comment. Do you know when that study started, what year?
I'm not positive the year that the Atlantic study started on.
Okay, because they easily could have tested that hypothesis about archival samples by just testing the same sample, you know, once a year ago or 2 years ago, and then just retesting the same sample.
Yeah.
Or is that not possible?
Sure, that suggests that the analytical characteristics are okay to use our older things, from my knowledge, but.
I didn't get that. What?
That other studies in the literature have shown that these assays, if you perform it on recut, like if you recut the block and not on old slides, that they are, you can still find similar rates.
Well, I know, but you're saying that archival specimens lose their reactivity. Can you show that the same, if a patient had it done, say, a year and a half ago and it was positive, and then you take that same block and recut it and do it now and it's negative, did they show that sort of, in the same patient?
Yeah, they didn't do that in the study.
Would have been very simple to do.
Any other questions or comments? All right, we can move on to the next one then.
So the second study here for discussion is once again published in Journal of Thoracic Oncology, and the lead author is Katsumata, and the title is Prognostic Impact of Number of Metastatic Lymph Nodes on the 8th edition of the TNM Classification of Non-Small Cell Lung Carcinoma. So as we know, the current TNM classification of lung cancer classifies nodal status based on the anatomical location on the defined nodal map. However, there's some prognostic heterogeneity in patients within the same nodal stage, and other solid tumors do include the number of metastatic lymph nodes as part of their staging system. So the objective of the study was to identify prognostic significance for the number of metastatic lymph nodes within the current TNM classification system. So in terms of the methods, it was a retrospective study that looked at 1,989 patients identified from a thoracic surgical database at a single institution in Japan between January 2003 and December 2012. The majority of the patients underwent a lobectomy, and 100 of the 1,989 patients underwent a pneumonectomy. Of note, 89% of the cases underwent an open thoracotomy, while only 11% of cases underwent a VATS resection. Patients who had pretreatments or those that had low-grade malignancy, including a carcinoid, mucoepidermoid carcinoma, or adenoid cystic, were excluded. And hilar and mediastinal lymph nodes were dissected en bloc with surrounding adipose tissue. The N1 station lymph nodes were removed en bloc with lung tissue and classified and separated by the pathologist into segmental and subsegmental stations. In the majority of the cases, they performed a systematic lymph node dissection. However, they did a lobe-specific lymph node dissection in 124 patients that had ground glass and were clinically diagnosed as stage 1 or 2, and in 178 patients that did not qualify for a systematic lymph node dissection due to other causes, such as ischemic heart disease or high bleeding risk. All sections were re-examined and classified based on the 8th edition of TNM classification, and patients were followed for at least 3 months for 2 years, and then at six-month intervals thereafter. All patients had at least 5 years of follow-up after surgery, and further CT or PET CT imaging was performed with any signs of recurrence. In terms of the results, the mean number of resected lymph nodes was 15.5, which fits with the kind of proposed minimum of 6 lymph nodes required for TNM classification. However, some groups have recommended that harvesting greater than 10 lymph nodes may increase accuracy staging. The majority of cases were small tumors, with 57% of cases in T1 categories, 27% T2, 10% T3, and 5% T4. 75% of the cases were node negative, so N0, 13% of cases were N1, 12% of cases were N2, and there was no N3 cases in the study. In the multivariate analysis for overall survival, the typical features such as age, male gender, invasive size greater than 1 centimeter, pleural evasion, pulmonary metastases, lymphovascular invasion, N1 node positivity, N2 node positivity were all associated with reduced overall survival. Additionally, the number of metastatic nodes compared to, where they're comparing the multiple nodes versus single nodes, as well as number of metastatic stations compared to multi-station versus single stations were associated with reduced overall survival. Multiple nodal metastases was an independent prognostic factor within the N1 disease category with a hazard ratio of 1.41, but not in the N2 disease. However, when they looked at increased numbers of positive nodes, so greater than or equal to 3, those were independent prognostic factors in both N1 as well as in N2 disease. So the study demonstrated that quantification of a number of positive metastatic lymph nodes had an impact on survival in addition to the current nodal staging in the 8th edition of TNM. Specifically, multiple nodal metastases was an independent prognostic factor in N1 disease, and lymph nodes greater than or equal to 3 were independent prognostic factors in both N1 and N2 disease. Some of the limitations of the study was it was a retrospective study that only involved cases from a single institution. And additionally, the majority of surgeries were performed with an open thoracotomy, and lymph nodes were provided as an en bloc dissection with surrounding adipose tissue that allowed for accurate quantification of the number of nodes by pathologists. So the specimens that are submitted more as fragments of a lymph node could potentially result in over-quantification of involved lymph nodes, and some additional studies need to be done to determine how to incorporate kind of fragmented lymph nodes. Kind of take-home message for this is that assessment of the number of positive lymph nodes may provide some additional prognostic information for patients with non-small cell lung carcinoma. It may help to address some of the noted prognostic heterogeneity within some of these specific nodal stages.
Okay. Thank you. Does anybody have any questions or comments regarding this? I guess my my concern always with quantitation of thoracic nodes is just as Matt highlighted. We often get them fragmented, and often counting nodes is not so easy as one as it may appear at first. So does anybody else have any comments, questions, or input on how you get your thoracic nodes and how you count them?
Yeah, I would like to know how people report their N2 nodes.
Problem. So I usually go like one specimen, you know, they send as one lymph node, but, you know, obviously it can be more than one. So my count may be probably lower than it is. But, you know, I cannot tell how else to do, you know.
Yeah, I think some of our surgeons have caught on to this fact, and if grossly to them it looks like more than one node, they'll actually submit them separately as, you know, separate sets of the same station so that we, in that case, I think most of us would count them separately. So I think a lot of our surgeons have started doing that, but certainly not all of them.
What about in elsewhere? How do you guys report your N2 nodes?
Well, if I can't tell a node versus multiple nodes, I just say multiple lymph node profiles. And then for the synoptic, just count it as at least one for that station.
So how do they handle that in the paper? Do they talk about the fragmented nodes? I mean, if they conclude that, how did they count them?
So all the cases, they had it submitted to them en bloc with the surrounding adipose tissue, and they were able to count grossly from that. And from their paper, they indicate that they were all submitted that fashion.
Since probably they're biased towards open thoracotomies.
Yes.
And not that. Any other questions or comments about that paper?
Did they actually have a specific suggestion how many nodes should be sampled? I mean,
that was just in the discussion, and they cited some other studies that had suggested that 10 was potentially a number that for the most accurate sampling.
Right, but they didn't have a conclusion based on their data.
They did not, no.
They did not.
Okay, we can move on to the next paper then. I'll cover this one. So an interesting study, I think, in Modern Pathology by Moore et al., and something that I think probably won't surprise most of us, but I thought it was kind of an elegant study is how they proved their hypothesis. It's entitled In Situ Growth of Early Lung Adenocarcinoma May Represent Precursor Growth or Invasive Clone Growth, a Clinically Relevant Distinction. So a little background here. Really, they are focusing here on the tumors that were described by Noguchi as type C tumors, so that have both invasive and in situ components. And they had noticed that those tumors actually seem to be a mix of probably two separate things. The tumors that really arise probably from adenocarcinoma in situ through minimally invasive adenocarcinoma and then to frankly invasive adenocarcinoma. But they also noticed that it seems that invasive adenocarcinomas can have kind of colonization, if you will, of the alveoli at the edge of the tumor. And that likely doesn't represent a true in situ component, that was probably a de novo invasive carcinoma that's just kind of colonizing the alveoli next to it. And I think the fact that we can see lipidic growth and metastasis in some cases would also kind of support that notion. So they basically had formed this hypothesis based on morphologic grounds and sought out to try to provide some evidence that this is actually the case, including some genetic evidence as well as immunohistochemical evidence. So they had a large cohort of around 1,000 adenocarcinomas, and they looked more carefully for their Noguchi C tumors, and they had 110 of them. So they applied three morphologic characteristics that they were able to apply to divide them into what they call Noguchi C1 and Noguchi C2. So basically, they came up with features that would indicate that a tumor is truly arising from a true in situ component. And there's three of them. So one of them was an obvious change in the nuclear grade from the lipidic component to the invasive component. So the invasive component looks higher grade compared to the lipidic component. Second, that the invasive component was kind of asymmetrically located, so not smack dab in the middle of the tumor. And I apologize, there was a typo in my document, but it's correct now in the Dropbox folder. But basically, if it was eccentric within the tumor, that would favor that it truly arose from an adenocarcinoma in situ, whereas if it's right in the center, that would indicate that maybe it's an invasive tumor that's colonizing at the edge. And going along with that was their third feature that they looked for, which they called a lipidic penumbra, which is a fancy way of saying that the lipidic component was kind of evenly distributed all the way around the tumor at an even thickness, so kind of a more symmetrical appearance. So if a tumor had at least two of these three characteristics, they called it Onoguchi C1, which is kind of the real in situ component, the adenocarcinoma in situ kind of progressing to invasion. And then they had tumors that had zero or only one of these characteristics, and they considered those basically colonization by the invasive adenocarcinoma or Noguchi C2. So they created a tissue microarray of a subset of their cases, so they had 44 tumors in the microarray. And that included 27 that were C1 and 17 that were C2. And they included both the lipidic and invasive components separately whenever possible of these tumors within the microarray. And then they did immunostains on the microarray for Ki67, P53, and bimental. And then they also tried to genetically analyze these separate components separately. So they used laser capture microdissection to sample the lipidic areas, and then they sampled the invasive components. And that they did that in 18 of the C1 tumors and then 5 of the C2 tumors, and they collected DNA for next-generation sequencing. So in the end, their cohort included 42 that were C1, so mostly lipidic predominant tumors that presumably had a true in situ component, and 68 of the C2 tumors that were mostly acinar predominant and presumably represented colonization of the alveoli by invasive tumor. They provided some evidence that the C2 tumors were more aggressive, so that they had a higher rate of nodal metastasis, so it was 26% in the C2 tumors versus only 8% in C1 that had nodal metastasis, and that was significant. However, when they looked at overall survival, they did not see an overall survival difference between the two groups. So then they got into more specifics regarding immunohistochemistry and genetic differences between these tumors. So Ki67 labeling index was one of their main criteria that they looked at to assess for potential aggressiveness. So overall, the C2 tumors had a higher Ki67 labeling index, as you might expect, And they also did not show any difference in the Ki-67 labeling index between the invasive component and what looked like the lipidic component. However, the C1 tumors did show a significantly higher Ki-67 in the invasive component compared to the in situ component, where the Ki was usually very low. So going along with that, about 20% of the C1 tumors showed acquisition of a mutant P53 staining pattern only in the invasive areas, while all of the C2 tumors that had a mutant P53 pattern were concordant. So basically the invasive tumor and the lipidic-looking tumor both had mutant P53. There wasn't this dichotomy when the tumor acquired an invasive phenotype. They used Vimentin as well and show that C1 tumors showed more Vimentin expression in the invasive component compared to the lipidic areas, and there was no difference, again, between the lipidic and invasive areas in C2 tumors. So then I looked at their genetic findings I thought were kind of interesting. So in their whole cohort, all of the Noguchi C tumors that they studied, they noticed that KRAS, EGFR, and BRAF mutations were really very common, and they were present in all components of all the tumors that they tested. So that would indicate that those are very early genetic events in pathogenesis, and likely in the tumors that did have a true in situ component were present early on in the in situ component of the tumor. They did find that a few C1 tumors, only 3 of 18, but still some of them did have private mutations that were only present in the invasive component. So the invasive component acquired, in two of the cases, P53 mutations, and then they had a few other SMAD4 and PIK3CA mutations as well. But none of the C1 tumors showed any private mutations in the lipidic component. So all of those were the same in the invasive and the lipidic areas. Overall, the C2 tumors were more likely to have P53 mutations, again, probably not surprising, and that was a quite striking difference, so that was 80% versus 17%, so that was quite a difference. And then finally, they found that actually when you were looking for kind of a single marker to prognosticate whether a tumor might be truly in situ or whether it might just be colonizing the alveoli, they found that actually the Ki-67 rate specifically of the lipidic or in situ-looking tumor was indicative of a difference in survival. So if the Ki-67 was less than 10%, they said that would indicate that that's true in situ or precursor growth, and those tumors had a better prognosis compared to tumors that had a greater than 10% Ki-67 in the lipidic component, which would indicate just outgrowth of an invasive tumor. And they have some nice Kaplan-Meier curves to show that, pictured in Figure 5 of the paper. So they concluded that they have presented some morphologic, immunohistochemical, and genetic evidence that tumors with a mix of lipidic and invasive growth represent a mix of tumors that are proceeding through kind of that AIS-MIA invasive tumor framework, but also there are tumors that are just fundamentally invasive and are just colonizing the surrounding alveoli. And I think, based on the morphologic criteria that they propose, I think we're going to be able to sort that out, just based on morphology in many cases. However, they point out that on small biopsies, this might be more difficult. I think probably most of the implications here are important for, morphologists like us, as well as when we go forward studying tumors that we are putting within the AIS-MIA framework. We kind of want to make sure that we're not overcalling tumors that maybe are just colonizing the alveoli around it. Again, I don't think this is surprising data. I think this makes good sense, but I thought it was kind of an interesting paper. Any questions or comments on that?
Did they give any inter-observer agreements to defining C1 versus C2?
They did not. They said that they had two pathologists do it, but they did not give any data regarding that.
It seems to me doing a Ki-67 and a TP53 would probably be more accurate than morphology, but that's just a test they didn't do.
Yep. Any other questions?
Hi, it's Margaret here.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Hi
there. I think this is really interesting because sometimes you'll see really ugly-looking cells in a lipidic growth pattern.
Yeah.
And I feel uncomfortable saying, oh, this is just a moderate, a well-differentiated adenocarcinoma. Like, I'm worried about these cases.
Yeah.
When it looks really ugly. And sometimes I've seen a half a centimeter tumor that was lipidic but had very ugly-looking cells binding the alveoli. And such a tiny tumor as well.
Yeah.
Without any invasion. So
yeah.
I was uncomfortable calling that in situ, but I had, you know, by the... Although I think if the tumor cells look highly malignant, we don't really describe them as in situ.
Yeah, I think sometimes those tiny tumors are actually the most difficult because you kind of have to make the call, well, am I going to call this whole thing invasive or am I going to call this whole thing in situ? And sometimes when they're really tiny like that, I think because your invasive measurement is going to be a high percentage of your tumor kind of overall volume when the whole tumor is only 4 or 5 millimeters across, I think those can be really tiny.
Yeah. Yeah.
All righty. So let's move on to the next paper. I think it's a good paper, and I think it's an interesting read. I would encourage all of you to read through it. It is a bit of a long paper, but I think it's well written. It's by Natasha Reckman and her group. It's published in Modern Pathology, and it's entitled Stage 4 Lung Carcinoids, Spectrum and Evolution of Proliferation Rate, Focusing on Variants with Elevated Proliferation Indices. So as we all know, when we're looking at mitotic counts for classifying carcinoid tumors that arise in the lung, we're looking for tumors with less than 2 mitoses for typical carcinoids, and between 2 and 10 for atypical carcinoids, and, of course, necrosis being the other criteria. However, they point out that all of that data was really generated from resected primary tumors, and how and if we should be applying those criteria to metastatic disease is really not so well studied, and it's not a terrifically easy thing to study since a low percentage of pulmonary carcinoids are stage 4. So they point out that in the GI tract, it seems to be more common for tumors to be more widely metastatic to the liver and other sites, whereas pulmonary carcinoids more often are low stage. So since only 5 or maybe 10% end up being stage 4, they're harder to study. And they also discuss Ki-67 quite a bit in this paper, which is not included in our current classification, but they do note that the WHO does suggest that pulmonary carcinoids should have a Ki-67 less than 20%, and that's specifically when using Ki-67 to basically rule in or out small cell carcinoma, which generally has a much higher Ki-67 than 20%. So that's what they put forth as kind of the general rules of thumb, that carcinoid tumors of the lung should have less than 10 or less mitoses per 2 millimeters squared and a Ki of less than 20%. But we all know that there are tumors that fall in the gray area of this classification, both, you know, primary, I guess, occasionally, but it seems more often we see these gray areas at the metastatic sites where they look like a carcinoid tumor, but they have more than 10 mitoses per 2 millimeters squared, but at the same time, you don't feel like they're really looking a classic for a large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma or a small cell carcinoma, and the mitotic rate, while it's maybe more than 10, it's kind of hovering towards that borderline and not to the degree that we would really like to see for a large cell or small cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. So that's kind of the crux of the issue of this paper. So they did a manual mitotic count as well as a manual Ki-67 assessment in 66 patients who had a stage 4 pulmonary carcinoid tumor. So they tried to include both the primary and metastatic lesions whenever possible, and included a mix of biopsy and resection. So actually the number of specimens that they reviewed was double about the number of patients included, since many patients had 2 or even 3 sites that were biopsied or sampled, had a resection done. So they also looked in a subset of cases, they did immunostains for RB and also targeted next-gen sequencing in cases specifically that showed increased proliferative index. So of the patients included in the study, 70% of them presented as stage 4 disease. So at the time their pulmonary carcinoid was discovered, they already had metastatic disease, and 30% of the time they had their primary tumor resected but then showed up with metastatic disease at a later time. Interestingly, only 20 of the patients had their primary tumors resected. The other ones just had a biopsy or had sampling of the metastatic lesions. And 80% of the cases that were resected were atypical carcinoids. So only 20% of those, a few handful of patients, had a typical carcinoid resected and then subsequently developed metastatic stage 4 disease. So 40% of patients had one site sampled. The rest had at least two. Some of them had three. And the most common metastatic sites that they observed included liver, bone, skin, and brain. So when they looked at mitotic counts at metastatic sites compared to primary tumors, they found that the mitotic rate did tend to be higher at the metastatic site. So the mean mitotic count at the metastatic site was 5.6 per 2 millimeters squared compared to 3 per 2 millimeters squared in the primary tumors. And that approached significance but was not actually, it was 0.06, the p-value. So mitotic counts greater than 10 were present in about 23% of the metastatic lesions. So that would exceed the current threshold for what is, you know, WHO criteria for even an atypical carcinoid. And three of them actually had more than 20 mitoses per 2 millimeters squared. So KI was generally higher in the metastatic lesions than in the primary tumor. And they had a hotspot, KI67, which actually exceeded 20%. So, again, that upper threshold that is suggested by the WHO, even though it's not currently incorporated into the classification. So KI67 over 20 was seen in 13% of primary tumors and about a quarter of metastatic lesions. So they then went on to really focus in on the tumors that really had an elevated proliferation index either. So that was either those that had more than 10 mitoses per 2 millimeters squared or a KI over 20%. So basically exceeded the current WHO threshold for what is acceptable for any typical carcinoid tumor arising in the lung. And they found that they found elevated proliferation in 27% of all samples tested. And that 42% of patients had at least one sample with an elevated proliferation rate at some course point during the course of their disease. And 90% of the samples that showed this increased proliferative activity were actually metastases. So much more likely to see a metastatic lesion with a high proliferative index that exceeded the WHO threshold, and often patients would actually have maybe one biopsy that had a more normal or acceptable proliferation rate, but then would have an additional biopsy and that they would see this increased proliferation. So six samples actually showed a very high, or not very high, but high mitotic count, actually exceeding 20 mitoses, and all of those were metastatic lesions. And they also noted that KI67 was often very heterogeneous, so you would often see hotspots on low power in a background of what looked like lower level activity. So as far as morphology, they said that the vast majority of cases with increased proliferative activity had what they described as a normal carcinoid morphology, so nested growth, typical neuroendocrine chromatin, a very classical appearance that looked like a carcinoid tumor. They had a few cases that did show some more poorly differentiated morphology, which they described as either sheet-like growth, increased NC ratio, maybe prominent nucleoli, and cellular crowding. But all those cases that showed those more poorly differentiated morphology either had classic areas of carcinoid tumor within the same biopsy or had another separate biopsy that showed a more classical appearance. So the patients with that increased proliferative activity did have a slight predominance of females and non-smokers. And interestingly, I think the median survival was 2.7 years, and that was not different from those that did not show this increased proliferative activity. So basically, all the stage 4 lung carcinoids had a similar overall survival, regardless of whether they showed increased proliferative activity or not. So when they looked at kind of more genetic or immunohistochemical evidence of whether these were truly carcinoid tumors, they found that RB expression was retained by immunohistochemistry in all their cases, and they also didn't identify any mutations in P53 or RB1, as you might expect in a high-grade neuroendocrine carcinoma, but they did find mutations that are common in carcinoid tumors, including mutations in MEN1 and other chromatin modifiers. And then finally, they did a comparison of multiple samples in the same patient. So they had 48 pairs, basically, of multiple samples in the same patient. And they noted marked heterogeneity of the mitotic rate and Ki-67 through the course of the disease. And the most common pattern, 35% of cases, they saw an increase in mitotic rate or a greater than 10% increase in Ki-67. However, they also noted that decreases did occur. So in some cases, the first specimen actually showed the increased proliferative activity, and a subsequent biopsy showed lower proliferative activity, but that only happened in 6 patients. And the rest of the patients, the rates were similar. So the Ki-67 and mitotic count were really similar between the two samples that were available. So their conclusions were that 1/4 of stage 4 carcinoid, they're going to exceed the current WHO mitotic rate and Ki-67 threshold. However, they're really not showing genetic features, morphologic features, or clinical outcomes that would be expected in a high-grade neuroendocrine carcinoma, or, you know, a small cell or large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, basically. They also noted that mitotic rate can escalate at metastatic sites in 35% of cases. And therefore, I thought one of their more interesting recommendations that the classification of pulmonary carcinoids as typical or atypical really probably is not applicable to metastatic lesions. And they actually recommended just calling these metastatic carcinoid tumor C-comment, and then in the comment describing the proliferative rate and or the Ki-67 labeling index, and not necessarily pushing them into the category of large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma just because they exceed the mitotic rate threshold, for example. They also, I think they talked quite a bit in various parts of the paper of how this group might be congruous to what is called grade 3 neuroendocrine tumor that's used in GI pancreas, so basically making a home for this gray area, because I think it happens commonly enough that it would be nice to have a home for these tumors and not be kind of forced to call them a large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, but I don't know what's going to happen in the new WHO regarding classification of pulmonary carcinoids, but there are certainly, I mean, Bill Travis is one of the authors of this paper, and there were several interesting hints, I thought. I don't know if anybody has any inside info on what's going to be happening in the new WHO, but seems to be paving the way for some changes in the classification of lung carcinoids, which I think would maybe be a good thing. So any questions or comments on that one?
So they included both atypical and typical carcinoids here, right?
Yes. The only criteria was that they were stage 4. So typical or atypical were included.
And there was no difference in the prognosis between just the way we typically classify typical and atypical.
Yeah, they didn't do a very good job of just saying, here's a Kaplan-Meier curve of what it looks like for typical or atypical. They really just grouped these all together and kind of threw the current classification out the window, if you will, and didn't really refer to them in that way other than giving the basics of, you know, what percentage were typical and atypical from the get-go.
Yeah, I agree with you. It sounds like they're paving the way to get rid of that typical and atypical category.
Yeah. And they commented on their in their discussion as well about kind of multidisciplinary oncology groups, both in the U.S. and Europe, pushing for a more universal classification, and also pushing for incorporation of Ki-67, specifically on small biopsies, but also potentially in classification that oncologists apparently are using Ki-67 data, whether we include it in our classification or not, that they use it especially in patients with high-stage disease. So, it feels like things are going to change. All right. I encourage you all to read that one. It's, I think, worth the time to put in there. All right. And then I just, in the last couple of minutes here, I'll just touch on this last paper, which I just thought was a nice kind of complement to the paper that we just covered. So this was a JTO article by Dinter et al. On the molecular classification of neuroendocrine tumors of the thymus. Anya was one of the co-authors on this one. So it's an in-depth paper, and honestly, it was, I was some parts of it I was not even understanding all of the genetic subtleties that they were talking about here, but I think the overall message is quite interesting. So the crux of the problem, I think, is that we're using the same kind of pulmonary classification system for neuroendocrine tumors of the thymus, kind of making an assumption that maybe they're the same or that the classification system would work at this site, even though there's evidence that they're quite different. You know, we see a preponderance of atypical carcinoids and large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, much more prominent in the mediastinum and thymus than we see in the lung. So I think kind of providing some evidence that maybe they're not so similar. And they point out there's also some genetic evidence that they're not as similar as well. So they included 103 patients with thymic neuroendocrine tumors. So they had 22 typical carcinoids, 51 atypical carcinoids, 28 large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas, and 6 small cell carcinomas. And they did Ki-67. They also did some immunohistochemical staining and some genetic testing. So the genetic testing they did included shallow hole exome sequencing, which basically provided a chromosomal instability score, which was kind of the crux of their genetic data. And they also did next-gen sequencing in just a small subset. So I'm kind of to cut to the chase here, their chromosomal instability data indicated that the chromosomal instability progressed from typical to atypical carcinoid to high-grade tumors. But they did have a few outliers in that classification. But when they did unsupervised clustering of that copy number alteration data, they found that they had 3 distinct clusters. So basically low chromosomal instability, intermediate chromosomal instability, and high chromosomal instability. So all of the small cells appropriately separated out into the high chromosomal instability group. But I thought it was interesting that large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma and atypical carcinoid in particular scattered throughout the 3 groups. So they did not show an orderly distribution into the chromosomal instability scores. And most of the typical carcinoids did cluster in group in cluster 1 with a few in cluster 2 as well. And they found that determining mitotic activity and necrosis were not able to predict the chromosomal instability cluster of any given tumor. So that was pretty interesting, and they found that the chromosomal instability data did divide the patients into 3 groups as far as prognostication goes, and that they also found the primary metastatic disease could be tested, and generally there was a progression in grade as well as chromosomal instability and the metastases compared to the primary tumor. They looked at some immunohistochemical data as well, and basically found that lower grade tumors tended to express chromogranin, where the higher grade tumors tended to be negative. And they also found EZH2 was commonly expressed in higher grade tumors, but not in lower grade. And then I think we're more familiar with the lower grade tumors having preserved RB and wild type P53. So I think the upshot of this was they have a chart in their paper, figure 5, I guess table 5, I'm sorry, where they basically described a potential grading scheme that would include morphologic criteria as well as IHC and genetic data. And it's because it includes genetic data that may not be available to everyone, I don't know if this will catch any traction, but I think the idea of the paper is a strong one that, you know, we probably need to think of these as their own entity and do a little bit more digging in order to really figure out the best way to prognosticate for these tumors and not just, apply the pulmonary system, which already has limitations that we've discussed, to thymic epithelial tumors, which seem to have quite a different disease distribution. So I think we're almost out of time. Any comments or questions on that one?
It's a surprise they gather 22 typical carcinoid out of 103.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even remember when was the last time I saw it, you know.
A typical carcinoid of the thymus?
Of the thymus.
Yeah, they really do tend to at least be atypical carcinoids or, you know, more often kind of large cells. The atypicals in large cells tend to be overrepresented. And they do, you know, specifically point out again that there seems to be these tumors that, while they technically fulfill criteria for large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, they're at the low end of the mitotic rate, and they really look like a carcinoid tumor, and I think we've all seen those as well in the thymus, that you kind of have to call them large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma per WHO criteria, but really they look more like a carcinoid tumor. And that, I think, this is paving the way to maybe finding a home for those tumors in a more correct classification.
Well, thanks a lot.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you. Great.
Yeah, thank you.
For conference.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please stand by.